In the old days, when our SEALs needed a dozen clean laptops, they went through acquisitions. Today, with WikiLeaks dumping every battle plan on the Internet, if there's an above-top-secret mission in Yemen that no one can ever find out about, well, acquisitions can't be trusted. And you certainly can't head over to the Best Buy with a shipping address that says the Pentagon. So all across the country there are places like mine. Shops run by nostalgic old vets who miss their old lives so much, they're happy to take delivery on whatever Uncle Sammy needs to keep quiet. And you know how we do it? The same way as those four magic tricks. Sleight of hand. Sleight of hand is the end result. But when it comes to selling a sleight, do you know the trick to the trick itself? Caesar paused, ever the showman, then pumped his overgrown eyebrows and cupped his hands together. The big motion covers the small motion. Like this. Shaking his still-cupped hands, he did a quick three-count, then lifted one hand away, revealing a familiar gold Seiko. "Is that my watch?" Sig asked.
"That's what you get for looking so hard at that envelope with the key," Caesar said, dangling the watch off his crooked finger and handing it back. "You asked about Houdini before. He used to do the same. He'd have you check his mouth for lockpicks and other files. But while you were doing that, no one would notice that good old Harry had six fingers. He'd wear a fake hollow pinky, where he'd store metal picks and a thin, bendable Geely saw that could slice through anything. Or he'd hook a lockpick on the back of your shirt while you examined him, then pull it off when you were done." He pantomimed his left hand moving high in the air. "The big motion," then closed the fist of his right hand, like he had something in it, "covers the small motion." So in this metaphor, the conjuring arts, these days, every country in the world, every enemy we have, has a team of computer nerds on staff. They watch the Pentagon, what we order, our supply lines. They watch the big moves. And while they're watching those big moves, they don't see the small ones being funneled through your little magic shop. Zig nodded. That part made sense. But what's that have to do with Operation Blue Book? You said you needed to make something right. Caesar cupped his hands again. 1, 2, 3. Then revealed a shiny silver dollar. He cupped his hands again. 1, 2, 3. Clink. Another silver dollar. Then, clink, another. Slowly, though, his expression changed, and 1, 2, 3. As a new silver dollar clinked against the others, his features fell, looking despondent. "Caesar, if you know something, I'm a good person." "A good American," Caesar insisted as, clink, he lifted his hand and another silver dollar appeared. "I served our country my entire adult life, and when they needed me to do a little more by helping with these shipments, I served again. In the beginning, it wasn't much. A new delivery would show up every 6 months or so. After 9/11, of course, more shipments started coming in. During the heyday, I signed for so many laptops, printers, flip phones, and chargers, I swear to Moses, our government was single-handedly keeping the CDW computer catalog in business. But again, that's the job, right? At least I'm in the game. I'm alive. Back from the dead. The amazing Caesar feels amazing again. So amazing that I didn't even realize they were about to play me for a sucker. It started a few months ago, when I got the kind of delivery you never want to sign for. No packaging. Just a briefcase. Military issue. Bomb-proof. They told me not to look inside. Zig sat there, silent. What was I supposed to do? I'm a breathing human, and they were stupid enough to leave it with someone who's a master at picking locks. I had to take a peek. And inside?
There it was. The deadliest weapon of all. Neat stacks of cash. $200,000.
You never moved cash before?
This is Uncle Sammy. Half the time I assumed I was moving cash. For this one, though, they said my contact would be someone named Houdini, which I thought was just their way of making fun of my store, like, ha-ha, you 80-year-old fool, you're spending your retirement in a magic shop. Then they told me the code name. Operation Blue Book.
46. You're looking at me like I'm supposed to know what that means, Zig said.
Even I don't know what their current operation is. But I know the history, the Amazing Caesar said. You never heard the stories? Houdini and his blue book?
I looked online. Said it was some sort of code book.
Not just a book. It was part of Houdini's act. At the peak of his fame, his shows had three parts. First, there was the magic.
In the palm of Caesar's hand, he squeezed the silver dollars. He opened his hand. Now they were gone.
Second, he'd do his escapes. From handcuffs, straitjackets, and of course the Chinese water torture one. But during the final years of his life, the best part of every show was when he'd expose the fraud of local mediums.
You mean like fortune tellers?
Back then they were called spiritualists. They even had their own religion. Spiritualism, based on the idea that you could talk to the dead. Today, of course, it makes you think of palm readers and crystal balls. But in those days, this so-called religion was big business.
And people believed it?
It was right after World War I. Families who lost their sons in battle got preyed upon by hucksters offering seances. To Houdini, whose heart was broken by the death of his mom, Zig said, remembering what Wag said, which he'd confirmed online.
Exactly.
Houdini felt that pain personally from the loss of his mother. From there, he made it his mission to go after spiritualists. He saw it as the most hurtful crime of all. Ripping open old wounds and taking advantage of someone's lost family member. Or lost child. I mean, can you imagine?
Zig could. He'd been imagining it since the moment he thought it was Nola in the morgue. Since the moment she returned to his life. The worst of it was last night, when she manipulated him into going to her office just to see who would follow. Zig could live with the maneuverings. Indeed, he had to respect her for a smart play like that.
No, for Zig. The real pain came from what it showed him about himself. A decade since the funeral, he wasn't a novice mourner. Zig knew where his scars were. He was used to living with them on a daily basis. Plus, he worked in death, spending years using it to inoculate himself against the shattered feeling that came with the loss of Maggie. To be around so many young fallen took away the greatest weapon in death's arsenal. Just being with other mourners. Zig no longer felt alone. And then, Nola appeared. This girl who saved his daughter. And in an eye blink, all that protective work was unraveled, tearing his skin off in sheets and reminding him of the one thing he'd worked so hard to overcome. The deepest wounds. The ones that pierce you to your core. They heal, but they never disappear.
Can you please tell me what this has to do with the blue
I already did? It was the secret of Houdini's trick, the secret behind all his tricks. Big motion covers the small motion, right? Caesar asked. Eric Weiss, a.k.a. Harry Houdini, was the big motion, the star of the show. But while everyone was focused on him, the real work was being done by Houdini's secret service.
His what?
That's what he called them. They were his closest confidants. His wife, his brother, an assistant named Amadeo Vaca, Zig blurted. You know him?
Zig shook his head, noticing a dim light outside. In the distance, up the block, a car came to a stop, its headlights glowing. It was parallel with the shuttle, still debating whether to turn. Vaca's name was listed as one of the passengers on board the plane that crashed in Alaska. Same with Rose Mackenberg and Clifford Eddy Jr. Both were also members of Houdini's Secret Service, Caesar said. So someone's using old Houdini names? That's our theory. Caesar took a long look at Zig, who was still studying the headlights outside. Even from here, there was no mistaking the siren on the roof. Police car. Mr. Zigarowski, those three names you just mentioned, they weren't the only people on the plane, were they? Please help me make this right. Was someone you care about on there, too? It's a long story. I'm 87. I've got time. I'm not sure we do, though, Zig said, motioning to the police car in the distance. I see him. Rental cops. We hire them for the neighborhood. They've passed us twice now, Caesar said as the car started moving, disappearing to their left. Anywho, you were saying? No, you were saying. About Houdini's Secret Service. Right. Before Harry got to a town, Vaca, Mackenberg, Eddie, and the others, they would come a few days early and do the recon work, figuring out everything from what brand of handcuffs the local police used, so Houdini would have a key when he challenged them to lock him up, to what kind of locks were on the jail cells. But their number one mission was to help Houdini prepare for the big finale of the act, exposing mediums and fake fortune tellers. It was Houdini at his sneakiest. Back then, whenever a medium would travel to a new town, they'd establish themselves by approaching someone in a prominent family and saying, I have a message for you from your dead brother, or dead mother, or whoever it was. Then they'd ID the person by name, like, someone named Maggie is in great pain. What did you just say? Back at my shop, you gave me your name, Mr. Zigarowski. You think I didn't do a quick Google search? I found the obituary. I'm sorry you lost your daughter. That's not your proving my point. Today the internet makes it easy. Back then, though, it would blow people's minds. How'd this stranger know all those details about me? But no one realized that the mediums themselves had their own underground network. They called it the Blue Book. In every town, they'd write down all the details of everyone who lived there. Mr. Montgomery recently buried his wife Abigail after she fell from a horse. Mrs. Addison is blind in one eye and lost a sister named Gertie. That's what it said online, that it was like a hobo code. With more details and info. Think of it as Google .01. They'd hide the Blue Book in a known spot, somewhere by the train station, and when different mediums would come to town, they'd study the book and immediately be ready to show off their amazing powers. In Houdini's act, he'd grab the Blue Book first, call the local mediums on stage, and show everyone what frauds they were. So when you opened that briefcase full of cash and saw the paperwork for Operation Blue Book, whoever's pulling the strings here, they're obviously Houdini superfans. They're using his old tricks, the names of his old agents. But what set me off wasn't the bomb-proof suitcase or even the cash inside it. It was the pickup man who came for it. The one they called Houdini. Like I said, I've been doing this since Nixon was cursing in the White House. Every 6 months or so, Uncle Sammy sends someone to my shop. We make small talk. They mention the code name. I give them a package. No one's perfect, but most people are generally nice. This guy Houdini, though. You ever give your car keys to a valet and start worrying about your house keys being on that key ring, too? Zig nodded, noticing that through the front windshield, a few blocks away, there was another set of headlights. A new car was slowly coming toward them. Nothing to worry about. At least, not yet. For most of my pickups, they send me Marines or SEALs. They're kids, messengers. But they're solid, like hammers, Caesar explained. This so-called Houdini, he was older, in his 40s at least, and when you spot a colonel suddenly doing a corporal's job, you know something's not right. That's why I popped the locks on his suitcase. Then after his first pickup, my phone rings again, and rings even more. Deliveries start coming more frequently. Every other month, then once a month, then every 2 weeks. And the suitcase? It's getting heavier. Whoever Houdini is, he's not just moving a few shekels. He's moving cash. More and more with each visit, all of it peaking 4 days ago when my phone rings and there he is, telling me that something big is coming, that I need to keep an eye out. And guess where that shipment was from? Alaska. Every time he came in, I swear, I had that bad feeling. But I'm a good American, Mr. Zigarowski. My orders were clear. Accept the cash and hand it over. Yet when I saw the news of that plane, I swear, I had that same bad feeling, praying it was just coincidence. But for you to show up now... Sacred Mary, if I caused those people's deaths... Caesar, you couldn't have... I knew. Deep in my belly, I could feel it. Every time he came in, I knew something was off. And then for him to start calling me personally, checking to see exactly when his suitcase would arrive. No one does that. It was like he had a personal stake in it. Hold on. Back up. He called you personally? So you know how to reach him? Yeah, sure. For emergencies only. Why? Zig thought about that. Then right there, Zig had a brand new idea. 47. Dover Air Force Base, Delaware.
What can I do for you, Mr. President? Let me first say I appreciate what you do there in Dover. We all do, Francis, President Wallace said, using Master Guns's first name. Even with admirals, most presidents do away with titles and keep things informal. Thank you, sir. To that end, I know you're busy. I'll keep this quick. We were wondering... He stopped himself, taking a moment. The concrete bunker was silent. I was wondering about that plane that went down in Alaska... He stopped again. I'd like to know how the investigation is going. Master Guns glanced at the two Secret Service agents, both of whom were now pretending to look down at the metal detector. It wasn't uncommon for White House staff to contact Dover. This week they were calling at all hours. But in 19 years, this was the first and only time a president had called directly. We're just getting started, sir, Master Guns said. I will say, I think we're proceeding along nicely. I'm glad to hear that, Francis, because as I understand it, you're our chief homicide investigator there, correct? Master Guns paused, sensing a trap. He'd never met President Wallace, but he knew all politicians were natural-born liars, especially the world's top politician. I'm not sure what you're getting at, sir. What I'm getting at... is that as chief investigator, you're the one who goes out in the field. Last month, when that helicopter with four of our soldiers went down in the Philippines, you immediately flew to the Philippines. When that corporal went on a shooting spree at our base in Turkey, you flew to Turkey the next day. You interviewed everyone, examined it up close, and made a determination. But here we are with a plane down in Alaska, an entire crime scene out in the snow. And you're still sitting there at Dover 4 days later. His dog tags clinked around his neck as he put them back on. Master Guns chose his next words carefully. Sir, if you're accusing me of something... Francis, do you know what's on my schedule after I hang up with you? Pardon me, sir? It's late in the day.
At this hour, I usually get my final briefing from my national security team. After that, I return phone calls, like the one I have to make to Senator Castronovo, who's been busting my chops on every damn cable show over the rehaul I proposed for the post office system. But tonight, do you know what I'll be doing instead? Writing a eulogy. I know you and Mr. Rookstool were close, Master Guns said, referring to the Librarian of Congress. I'm sorry you have to... Don't be sorry. This is my honor. Nelson was in my wedding party. On the night my son was born, he brought a wiffle ball back to the hospital. If he were just a friend, I'd have our top speechwriter write his eulogy. She'd do a beautiful job, too. But for Nelson... The president made a noise, a grunt that sounded like, nuh-uh. When I stand there at his funeral on Friday, when I look down at Nelson's son and two daughters, at his 10-year-old grandson, this is a story only I can tell. So once again, Francis, tell me why you're sitting on your thumbs in Delaware rather than sitting on a plane heading to Alaska. Because it's my job, sir. No. Your job is to find out why that plane went down. No, Master Guns said as both Secret Service agents turned at his tone. Master Guns stared back, still gripping the phone. With all due respect, sir, my job is to investigate. And as we both well know, a few hours after that plane crashed in Alaska, two men in suits were waiting in my office, demanding Sergeant Brown's body. Do you know what that did to the investigator in me? It told me to start investigating anyone who's interested in that body, or, more importantly, this case. To my surprise, sir, that person is now you. The phone went silent. Not for long, though. The president's voice stayed calm and steady. Like yesterday out on the runway, no matter how hard the wind blew, Wallace didn't let a hair on his head get out of place. I'm glad to hear that, Francis, because the very last thing I want is for you to go easy on this. I can assure you, I never go easy, Mr. President. Honesty is my true north. Funny you should mention that, Wallace said, and right then, Master Guns realized the trap wasn't coming. It had already been sprung. Earlier today, Francis, the service took a look at Dover's security records. And you know what they found? According to the card swipe systems in your building, an ID with your name on it was used to access a room called Personal Effects. But when they cross-checked their other reports, they realized that a mortician named Jim Zagorowski was attacked in that exact room at that exact time. Master Guns stood at full attention, replaying how he let Zig use his ID to take a quick look in the room. I would never hurt Zig. That's the right answer, Francis. And I assume that if we look at all the photos that were taken out on the runway, we'll find one with you on the back of the plane at the same time you were supposedly in that personal effects room. But the fact remains that even if you weren't the one who personally attacked Mr. Zagorowski, the person who did it was someone who knew that he would be there at that time. And as far as my people can tell, you're one of the few who fit that bill. In fact, Francis, you're the only one who fits that bill. Zig is my friend, and Nelson Rookstool is my friend. The most powerful man in the world said, do your job, Francis, because I promise you, we'll be doing ours. Before Master Guns could say a word, there was a click. The President of the United States was gone. The agent with the heart-shaped face pointed to the door. This is the easiest way I know how to get out, Master Guns said, plowing toward the exit. In the hallway, he waited for the steel door to slam behind him. Then he pulled out his phone, the one his wife didn't know about. Master Guns sent a quick text. We need to talk.
48. Washington, D.C. Nola was cold. She was hungry, too, with nothing but a scattering of granola bar wrappers tossed across the passenger seat. Granola bars were never a proper meal, no matter how many you ate. She'd been sitting in the car for hours now, her notepad propped against the steering wheel as she drew another sketch, in green pencil, of the old storefront diagonally down the street. She liked using green in winter. Made everything seem serene. According to phone records, this was the one landline Marcus called from his cell, squeezed between a check cashing place and a liquor store. Powell Rock, Inc. It was an insurance agency. Prudential. The front glass window had the old 80s logo that built the Rock of Gibraltar out of a few slanted lines, with these words underneath. Get a piece of the rock with Benjamin R. Powell. Prudential updated the logo years ago. The same wasn't true of the storefront. With its peeling sign and tattered blue-striped awning, it was decades past its golden days. As Nola continued to draw, new details popped out. The pattern of zigzagging cracks in the storefront's wood paneling, rotting underneath. The rust streaks below the gutters. Definitely a leak there. And the subtle sag of the roofline that made the front sign look higher on the right than on the left? Foundation problems for sure. Yet of all the details in Nola's sketches, the most noticeable was what wasn't there. People. For hours now, no one went in the place, no one came out. Not a big deal for most insurance agencies. Walk-ins had to be rare. But here, there were no customers, no employees, no deliveries, nothing. Even after lunch, when the rest of the street swelled with locals, Powell Insurance was lifeless. Only one way to find out what's going on. Readjusting the mesh baseball cap that she'd bought at a gas station, Nola picked up her new disposable phone and started to dial. But as she entered the number, across the street in front of the coffee shop, a quick movement caught her eye. A fluffy white dog, a Bichon, no, a Havanese, was being yanked on his leash, back toward his owner, a heavy man with a beard. Middle-aged, expensive shoes, expensive gloves, likes to be noticed. He was talking, leaning in toward a younger woman. Late 30s, no lipstick, no wedding ring. Still deciding if she's buying his bullshit. The dog let out a high-pitched whine, trying to get to a nearby tree in front of the coffee shop. The dog had to pee. The man yanked the pup back, then yanked him again, still focused on the woman. The dog was begging now, whining and pleading, like he was in pain. Yank! Nola was tempted to get out. Tempted to have a few words about the way this man was treating his dog. But now wasn't the time. Stay focused, she thought, entering the final digits of the phone number. But just as she did, the man gave another yank, a hard one that, as the dog was in mid-jump, sent the furry animal crashing on its back, scrambling to right itself. Shutting her phone and tossing her sketchpad aside, Nola kicked open the car door. Damn it. She cursed herself, knowing she was being stupid. But as the dog let out a yelp, screw it, she headed straight toward the man. The dog was rattled now and skittish, looking up as Nola got closer. She walked up to the man. His lower teeth slanted sideways like half-fallen towers of Pisa. No braces when he was young. To afford those shoes and gloves, he worked for it.
You got something to say?
The man challenged, turning toward Nola, expecting her to back up. She stayed where she was. Your dog's trying to tell you something.
You fucking kidding me?
Mason, not here,
the woman warned. This wasn't the first time he lost his temper. Nola turned to Mason, so close that her elbow was now touching the woman he was talking to, edging her out of the way. I have a thing about animals, Nola said. She glanced at him and let him take a good long look at her black eyes with flecks of gold. Let him see the depth of the hole he was about to step into. In her pocket, she was still holding the green pencil she'd been sketching with. She eyed 14 places to impale him, 6 of them deadly. This close to the man, she saw the hair plug divots along his forehead, The edge of the contact lenses in his slowly widening eyes, and even the one stray thread sticking up at the collar of his designer wool overcoat. Over his shoulder, people in the coffee shop were starting to stare, including a Native American woman with a long black ponytail, dressed casually, sipping her latte and looking up from her newspaper. The white dog continued to whimper.
Go potty, Cracker Jack. That's it, go potty, the man said, letting the dog drag him toward the tree where Cracker Jack quickly relieved himself. Happy now? The man asked.
Nola ignored him, locking eyes with the man's girlfriend. You can tell a lot about a person by how they treat their dog. Leaving them behind, Nola headed back to her car as she pulled out her phone and quickly redialed the number for Powell Insurance. Time to get some answers.
49. The amazing Caesar had a throbbing pain in his hip. The doctors blamed it on the way he carried his weight, always leaning to one side as osteoporosis compressed his spine. They told him he should take it easy, whatever that meant. But as Caesar began dialing the phone number from the back of his magic shop, he was still leaning on his left side. At a certain age, you can't change who you are. Hello? You there? Caesar asked into the phone as someone picked up. It was quiet on the other end, and Caesar could feel an unnerving silence seeping through the large room, a long rectangular space almost as big as the public part of the shop, though far less cluttered. There was an old oak desk, tall and short mismatched file cabinets, but really most of the room was empty, facing the huge metal roll-up door that led to the alley. This wasn't an office. It was a shipping and receiving area. Everything okay? Asked the man known as Houdini. He sounded annoyed, but there was something else in his voice. Concern, and a real sense of charm, like he was worried about Caesar. Something came in today, Caesar offered. A package. For you. Houdini went silent. No one mentioned any shipments. I'm just relaying what's here. And from the smell that's leaking from it, I think you may have a problem. The smell? It actually smells. Bad, Caesar insisted. Houdini knew what that meant. Counterfeit money had its own odor from the printing. It made no sense. The government wouldn't use phony money, which meant this was from someone else. So now Houdini was curious. Any idea who sent it? Houdini asked. I'll just sign for deliveries. If you want, I can send it back. No, it's fine. It's good. If you want, I'll be right over, Houdini said. You'll stay late, yes? Sign outside says closed, but I'm in back. That's all Houdini needed to hear. With a click, he was gone. Caesar hung up the phone and sat back in his chair, leaning to the left. 7 people were dead. This was his chance to make it right. He's on his way? Zig asked behind Caesar. You put meat in the trap. You'll get the lion, Caesar said. Now you just have to figure out what to do with him.
50. Homestead, Florida, 10 years ago. This was Nola when she was 16.
Get over here,
Royal growled, grabbing Nola hard by the arm. Breakfast was finished, and she was in the kitchen doing dishes. The water was running, Nola reaching back to shut the faucet even as Royal tugged her to the door. If it kept running, she'd pay for that, too.
What did I do?
Nola asked, replaying the last few hours. Saturday laundry had already started. Yesterday's shopping was done. She'd put all his change by his wallet except for the few quarters she always stole.
Was this about the quarters?
Move your ass,
he insisted, kicking open the screen door and pulling her into the backyard. She tripped over one of their new but crooked patio stones as they headed for the overturned kiddie pool. Nola knew what the pool covered, the hole underneath, a new one that Nola had been digging since they moved to this new house.
You see this?
Royal asked. She was off balance, her hands still wet with dishwashing soap, tiny, sudsy bubbles popping along her fingertips. Next to the kiddie pool, she eyed the nearby shovel with the pointy spade.
Dummy! Look!
He was pointing straight up, at the sky. It was morning, but the moon was floating there, a faint half-circle visible in the pale blue sky. Like a chalk drawing, Nola thought.
Pick one,
Royal said.
The what?
Pick one. The sun or the moon?
He pointed up at both, though the sun was mostly out of sight.
Pick!
Nola paused, thinking it was a trick. Royal was too calm, the bounce in his voice too happy.
Come on, Nola, pick! Sun or moon?
I don't get it.
He rolled his eyes, now annoyed.
Listen, I know I'm not a good dad, okay? I don't buy you stuff. With the business,
he said, referring to the passport and other forgeries he was now doing on an even bigger scale.
I need to put our cash into printers and laminators, rather than wasting it on useless toys or presents. It lets us have a nice life. This new house,
he explained.
But someone told me this story. I think it's from a movie or a book. This dad tells his kids to pick a star in the sky. That way, when all the wealthy kids' presents are gone, his kids will always have that star, you know? I just figured, I don't know, if stars are good, the sun or the moon's better. I mean, today's your birthday, right?
Nola nodded. He never remembered her birthday. Not for years. And he rarely bought her anything, not when he could make more cash upgrading his ever-expanding document business, which had recently caught the attention of Royal's new boss, Mr. Quentin Wesley. From the bus ads she'd seen around town,
got a mess? Call Wes.
Wesley was a local immigration lawyer. He was also a crook, Nola decided, considering how many fake social security cards, phone bills, and driver's licenses complete with magnetic strips Royal was churning out in their back bedroom for seemingly hundreds of Wesley's undocumented clients. Wesley told Royal from the start,
"Your work is truly masterful."
According to the bus benches, Wesley also did a little criminal law, which brought an influx of ex-cons. Royal didn't mind convicts. Everyone deserved a fresh start. But when Wesley asked Royal to build a top-shelf wallet for a 50-year-old pedophile who was tired of everyone knowing his business, Royal refused.
"Now you're suddenly a snob? Peds pay top dollar,"
Wesley had told him.
"Don't care,"
Royal had shot back. "Every man has a line. Even Royal wouldn't do that."
"So there's my gift,"
Royal told Nola.
"Your choice, the sun or the moon. Just fucking pick one, all right?"
Nola looked up toward the sky. Her voice was soft.
"The moon."
"Yeah,"
Royal said, craning his neck and looking up with her.
"Me too."
For a minute, the two of them stood there in the backyard, both of them staring up at Nola's new and only birthday present. Finally, Royal headed toward the house, glancing back at Nola over his shoulder.
"I'm not a total asshole, you know."
51. Washington, D.C. Today. The curtain wasn't happy with her coffee. It was supposed to be an artisanal Indonesian blend, a mix of toffee, citrus, and tangy herbs. But the bitter taste told her the beans were too finely ground. Typical. You need them coarser to get the full flavor, which made her think of that luscious cold brew she had in Kyoto, Japan on the night she tracked down and opened the wrists of that German snitch who always smelled like cough drops.
"You still see her?"
a voice asked through her phone.
"You have to ask?"
the curtain shot back, glancing outside where Nola had just gotten out of her car.
"You're lucky you found her."
It wasn't luck. Once the curtain realized Nola had grabbed Marcus's phone, it was only a matter of time until Nola went through the records and tracked the landline for Powell's insurance. No different than what the curtain would have done herself.
"You sure she hasn't seen you?"
"Stop talking," the curtain was about to say. But to her surprise, Nola was now storming straight toward the coffee shop. The curtain slid her hand in her pocket, readying her blade. That is, until Nola stopped short, approaching a fat man outside who seemed to be strangling his hyperactive dog.
"What's she doing now?"
the voice asked in the curtain's ear. "Picking a fight."
"What? With who?"
"Not important. I'll call you back," she said, hanging up. Cradling her coffee cup but never drinking from it, the curtain turned her attention outside, watching through the plate glass as Nola stepped into the fat man's personal space.
Rash, the curtain thought,
calling attention to herself. Plus, not taking the time to assess who this guy might be. Nola was fighting angry now. Fighting dumb. And for what? At the end of the leash, a little white pup was whimpering, fighting to relieve itself.
A dog? Really?
The curtain made a mental note. She'd been told Nola was disciplined, unemotional. That's what made her so dangerous. But here it was. Proof that she could be stirred up just like every other slob in the world. It was a detail the curtain wouldn't soon forget. Outside, as Nola argued with the man, she suddenly glanced up. For a peek a second, she and the curtain made eye contact, 20 feet apart, separated only by the front window of the coffee shop. Nola quickly turned back to the fat man, glowering at him, until he finally realized this wasn't the kind of fight he'd be walking away from. The curtain made a mental note of that, too. Everyone thought Nola Brown was a wild card, but if you watched anyone long enough, even the wildest of cards gets played with its own predictability.
"How's the coffee?"
a young barista called out. He was cute. Trendy but edgy beard. Someone the curtain would hit on if it were another day.
"Perfect,"
the curtain said, taking a fake sip. Outside, Nola headed back to the car. Her back turned.
52. "You look like death," the man known as Houdini called out. "It's called old age," the amazing Caesar said as the roll-top back door rose upward, revealing his guest, a 40-something man with thinning black hair who was chewing gum so aggressively you'd think it was an Olympic event. "What's your excuse?" "You're funny for someone from the Great Depression," Houdini shot back, stepping inside, hiding his gum in his cheek and flashing his toothy grin. It was a natural smile, one he used to his advantage to offset the intensity of his pointy fox face and skeptical brown eyes. "Really, though, you don't look so good." "Yeah, well, see how you're looking when every time you sneeze you piss a little puddle in your pants," Caesar said, hitting a button and lowering the door. Houdini forced a fake laugh as he shook hands with the old man. He didn't mind the chit-chat with Caesar. To be over 80 years old and still in the game, still feeling your blood flowing? Isn't that what everyone wants? Yet as the door rolled down, Houdini was again chewing, checking over his shoulder, making sure no one was following. He didn't mind talking with Caesar, but that didn't mean he trusted him. "So I hear you've got a new rabbit in your hat," Houdini said, motioning with his chin at the soft leather briefcase on the nearby desk. "Came in a few hours ago. Same as always," the old magician said, meaning it was addressed to Caesar, but with an H as his middle initial, for Houdini. Chewing his gum even harder, Houdini stared at the case. Most of his deliveries came in a bomb-proof attaché. This was cheap, faux leather, like something from an office depot. "No return address?" Caesar shook his head. Chew, chew, chew. "You try the lock?" Houdini asked, eyeing the small padlock on the main zipper. "I'm just a messenger." Chew, chew, chew. Houdini could smell the briefcase from here, or at least what was in it. That sweet and sulfury stench, printer's ink, which meant counterfeit money, which meant someone new was at the table, or even worse, that someone had found out what Houdini and his partner were really up to. Either way, whoever that someone was, they were trying to get Houdini's attention. And right now, it was most definitely working. "You okay?" Caesar asked, adding a final verbal shove. The people who died on that plane deserved his very best.
Absolutely. Houdini grabbed the briefcase. It felt light. There wasn't much in it. Chew, chew, chew. By the way, last time, that magic trick you gave me for my nephew? The teleporting key, with the metal key that comes free from the key ring. He like it? It was too hard for him. He's 14 and lazy. Maybe you got something simpler, like that plastic box where you put the quarter in, then turn it around and the quarter disappears. Caesar rolled his eyes. Magic money, he said, leaving the back room and heading into the main part of the store. It comes in a starter set, he explained as he reached a bookshelf and grabbed a box labeled Ages 5 and Up. That's the one. I know it's easy, but he's a stupid kid. He'll love it, Houdini said, standing just behind Caesar. You mind opening it up? As the old magician pulled the toy from the box, he was thinking so much about the Alaska victims, he didn't even feel the gun that was now pressed to the back of his head. Pfft. A spray of blood hit the bookshelf. Caesar swayed a moment, then crumbled, his legs first, then his upper body, plummeting to the wood floor like all his bones, suddenly disappeared at once. Thump! The amazing Caesar took his final bow, his body convulsing as a small red puddle widened below him. I humbly apologize to your family, wherever they may be, Houdini whispered. He meant it. He liked the old man, and certainly appreciated all the help he'd been over these past months. But there was a reason they called him Houdini. The man who made all problems disappear. Caesar's body continued to jerk. Houdini kept his head down, away from the video cameras, then stepped over the body and leaned down, grabbing the plastic magic trick for his nephew. Then he figured, what the heck, and snatched the entire starter set, stuffing the small box in his coat pocket. It was nearly Christmas, for Christ's sakes. Within a minute, briefcase in hand, Houdini was out the back door, weaving through the alleys behind the magic shop. His first stop, same as always. A few blocks away, Houdini turned the corner and checked over his shoulder. No one there. On his left and right, he scanned every parked car. All looked empty. There were plenty of people scattered across the sidewalk. Most of them headed to or from the brand new Safeway supermarket on the next block. This block, though, was a relic of the past, which is why Houdini picked it. Across the street was a run-down storefront with a sagging striped awning. The front glass was covered in a giant peeling Prudential Insurance sticker that had these words in a smiley face curve below the logo. Get a piece of the rock with Benjamin R. Powell. Crossing the street and approaching the thick glass door, Houdini smelled the stale cigarettes inside. For the money they were paying, couldn't they clean up the place a bit? Glancing over his shoulder one last time, he again scanned all the parked cars and every nearby storefront window. Convinced he was alone, Houdini opened the front door. It closed silently behind him.
53. 6 minutes ago.
Powell Insurance, a woman answered.
I want to buy insurance, Nola blurted into her phone, sitting in the driver's seat, once again sketching in her notepad with the green pencil. She was drawing the woman on the phone based solely on her voice. Curt. Trying to sound nice, but subtly annoyed. Someone who had no problem lying.
I'm sorry, all our agents are really busy right now. Can I take your number?
I can hold, Nola said, looking out the front windshield and down the block at the storefront that clearly had a light on but no movement inside. I'm a friend of Benjamin's, she added, reading the name from the front window. Get a piece of the rock with Benjamin R. Powell. The receptionist went silent.
Ben passed away in 2003.
Did I say Benjamin? I think I had the wrong guy, Nola said, noticing just how many people were headed to the nearby Safeway supermarket now that work was over. This late in the day, like any commercial block in Washington, it was a mix of faces. Whites, blacks, Asians, the usual professionals in their usual professional wear. Underneath their coats was a fashion range that for women stretched from Banana Republic to Ann Taylor, and for men, Joseph A. Bank to Brooks Brothers. Still sketching away, she started drawing the coffee shop across the street, suddenly recalling the Native American woman with the long black ponytail. Nola looked for her. She was gone.
What did you say your name was again?
The receptionist challenged a bit too aggressively. I didn't, Nola replied, her green pencil no longer moving. She turned her attention down the block to the insurance agency. I appreciate the help. I'll call back later.
Ma'am, if you'll just tell me your name...
Nola shut the phone, eyes still on the storefront. Whatever was happening inside, there was only one way to find out. Time to go in. On the front dashboard was an open pencil tin. Nola tossed her green pencil inside and snapped the tin shut. From her waistband, she pulled out her gun, sliding it in her coat pocket. Nola started to elbow open the car door, and then, up on the next block, a man darted across the street. Balding. Close-cropped black hair. Fox-shaped face. Nola thought he looked familiar. He was carrying a briefcase, chewing gum like a teenager, and heading straight for Powell's insurance. Taking out her phone, Nola pulled up a photo. LinkedIn headshot. Same receding hairline. Same fox face. This was him. Perfect match. Last night on the boat, as Marcus begged for his life and pissed all over himself, he finally gave up his boss, or at least who he reported to. And now here he was, Foxface with the briefcase. Real name, Rowan Johansson, also known as Houdini, one of the few people who knew what Operation Blue Book really was, and who no question had a hand in putting down the Alaska plane that took Camille's life. Mungle. Faber, Stadler, Ticonderoga, Swan, Nola said to herself. She clenched her jaw so hard her teeth made an audible crack. Out the front windshield, Nola watched as Houdini glanced over his shoulder, taking one last look around. For a second, it looked like he was staring right at her. Mongol, Faber, Stadler, Ticonderoga, Swan. Deep down, Nola secretly hoped she'd been spotted. Then her next move would be easy. But the way the bill of her cap was blocking her face, plus the fading light, no way could he know she was here. Down the block, convinced he was alone, Houdini switched his briefcase to his left hand and used his right to tug open the front door of the insurance place, right-handed. The door was old, heavy. It slapped shut behind Houdini as he disappeared inside. Nola counted to herself. One. Two. Kicking open her car door, Nola crossed the street at mid-block. In her pocket, she gripped her gun. Mongol. Faber. Stadler. Ticonderoga. Swan. Like before, it wasn't helping. Though sometimes that wasn't a bad thing.
54. 6 minutes ago.
You still see him?
He's there.
I see him,
Sig whispered, ducking down by the steering wheel as Houdini turned the corner diagonally across the street. He was heading away from Sig.
I assume he can't see you?
Dino asked through the phone. It was an absurd question, making Sig wonder if looping Dino in was a mistake. Naturally, Sig tried Wags first, but for the past half hour, Wags was nowhere to be found. At least with Dino, Sig had extra eyes and ears, as well as someone to pull the emergency cord if it all went bad.
What about the old magician?
Dino asked. Any word from the amazing Caesar?
I called. He didn't pick up,
Sig whispered.
You sure he's okay?
I told you he didn't pick up.
You should still check in on him, even if he was feeling guilty. This guy Caesar put his life at risk for you. Make sure he's okay.
I will. After we... Sig cut himself off. Diagonally across the street, Houdini paused at the front door of an insurance shop, checking over his shoulder. Sig scooched down slightly, but otherwise didn't move. Didn't say a word.
Houdini tugged on the door and stepped inside, disappearing.
I gotta go, Zig said.
Stop. Tell me where Houdini is.
Insurance place. Prudential. I need you to look it up. See who owns it.
Ziggy, don't be stupid. Stay where you are. You have no idea what you're walking into.
This guy knows what Operation Blue Book is. He's the one. That's the reason the plane crashed in Alaska.
Whatever this Blue Book thing is, you don't even know if this is part of it.
He took 7 lives, Dino. Innocent lives, Zig hissed with a guttural roar, spit flying from his lips.
Dino went silent, knowing that tone in his friend's voice. A tone last heard on that night when Zig made the poor choice of taking on a 6'4" Marine who was screaming in the parking lot and gripping the arm of his sobbing girlfriend. When Zig jumped in, even the girlfriend turned on Zig, shouting that he should mind his own damn business. The Marine did far more damage, fracturing Zig's eye socket. Still, Zig wouldn't stop swinging, even as the blood turned the sclera of his eye completely red. Only later in the emergency room did Dino realize it was the night of what would have been Zig's 20th wedding anniversary.
Ziggy, you're picking the wrong fight here. Let me call the cops.
Zig barely heard the words. Reaching for the door handle of the car, he looked outside and...
Mother trucker, Zig muttered.
Down the street, a new person got out of their own car as Houdini entered the insurance place. Her head was down, but even under whatever baseball cap she was wearing, there was no mistaking her stark white hair.
Nola, Zig blurted. Nola? Where?
Dino asked through the phone.
She's there?
Mm-hmm, Zig said, his hand still on the door handle. Staring through the windshield, he felt like he was watching her on TV. Her head was down and her back was to Zig, so she couldn't see him. But the way she was moving, like the best soldiers on a sneak. Small steps, each one slow and careful. She knew exactly where she was going. She wasn't the only one. In a single smooth movement, Nola pulled open the door and stepped into the insurance place. Yet as the door swung shut, a brand new figure stepped out of the crowd, just outside the Safeway, across from the coffee shop. Another woman, Native American, wore a hunting jacket, a black one with loads of pockets. Even from here her walk stood out, the same slow and careful steps. Military training for sure.
What the crap is going on?
Zig whispered. He had no idea she was called the Curtain, but he knew a threat when he saw one. The woman stopped near the corner, still a block and a half away. Zig squinted through the dark. Unlike Nola, who was small and compact, this woman was wide-shouldered.
Ziggy, tell me what the hell is happening, Dino insisted.
I'm still trying to figure it out. Taking her time as she crossed the street, the big Native American woman looked around, scanning every inch of the grid that soldiers are trained to examine. Zig leaned forward even more in his seat, squinting as she crossed the street and made her way toward the insurance agency. No question. Her posture was perfect. But the way her left shoulder looked higher than her right one, she was carrying something under her field coat.
She's wearing a strap, for a gun. Or something worse, Zig blurted.
You don't know that. The woman approached the front door of the insurance agency. Unlike Nola, she paused, standing there in the cold, scanning the block one final time. Then she disappeared inside.
They're ambushing her, Zig said.
This isn't your fight. Don't do something stupid. Kicking open the car door, Zig hopped outside. The wind was cold, scratching at his face.
Ziggy, I'm calling the cops. They'll be there in minutes.
She'll be dead by then, Zig barked, already across the street. He stuffed his phone in his pocket, though he didn't hang up. If things went upside down, at least Dino could be a witness.
Ziggy, you haven't seen this girl for years, Dino shouted,
though Zig couldn't hear it. Running full speed, Zig darted for the insurance shop. Get a piece of the rock with Benjamin R. Powell, he read to himself as he caught his breath. His right hand gripped the knife in his pocket. His left gripped the door handle. Swallowing hard, Zig gave the door a tug. and stepped inside.
55. 6 minutes ago. Houdini hated it here. Hated the way the whole insurance agency reeked of stale cigarettes, carpet fresh, and mediocrity. But hated even more that it reminded him of his grandparents' place.
Evening, darling. How can I—
The middle-aged receptionist called out, cutting herself off. She had braces and a tattoo that read Cha-Cha vertically down her forearm. Looking up from her cell phone, she spotted Houdini, then looked right back down, just like she was paid to.
You got scissors? Houdini asked, approaching her desk.
Pardon?
Scissors. You know, scissors.
From a neon orange pencil cup, the woman pulled out a pair of scissors, keeping her eyes down as she handed it over.
Muchas gracias, Houdini said, standing there and chewing his gum for an extra half a second, as if he were waiting for her to say something back. She knew better than that.
Picking up speed as he headed for the back of the office, Houdini made a quick left, then right, navigating a small hub of cubicles, all of them empty. For months now, after each package pickup, Houdini came here, to the back of Powell Insurance, to this frosted glass door and its big 80s-era half-moon door handle that looked like a frown. Yanking it open, he revealed a wide conference room with a formica oval table at the center and a built-in kitchen along the left-hand wall. The refrigerator door was propped open. It was clearly unplugged, filled with file boxes. On the oval table were two dirty ashtrays, as well as the most valuable thing in this entire shithole. An ancient corded telephone. Time to tell the man in charge. In the current world of high-tech surveillance, where the government can access everything from your internet-connected doorbell to the microphone in your Wi-Fi-enabled cable box, it's not that hard to trace a cell phone. So the safest way to make a private call these days is to use the one technology even the government doesn't have the manpower to check anymore. A plain, old-fashioned landline.
Malvina, I dial a 9 first, then a 1, Houdini shouted at the wall, which was covered with awful landscape paintings in gaudy gold frames.
At the head of the table were 4 wall clocks, all in a row, labeled London, Tokyo, Los Angeles, and Washington, D.C., though they were all now stopped, showing 4 incorrect times.
9, then 1. The receptionist shouted back.
Letting the phone ring, Houdini tossed the briefcase on the conference table. The padlock was still in place. The zipper wouldn't budge. Time to find out what was inside. Cradling the receiver with his chin, Houdini gripped the scissors like a knife and plunged it into the side of the soft leather briefcase. Slicing down, he made the hole wider and wider until... click. Someone picked up.
Talk,
a man with a wood chipper of a voice insisted through the phone. Houdini rolled his eyes.
I'm not hired help. You sure about that?
You're a dick.
Spit your gum out. Makes you sound like a child.
Houdini made a patoo noise, though he didn't spit the gum out.
Our magician friend, he finally said, referring to the amazing Caesar, is not feeling so good.
What about the most recent present?
He's a clueless old dinosaur. Had no idea where it came from. But I'm telling you, someone's stepping in our shit. We need to...
Houdini said, wedging his fingers into the side of the cheap leather briefcase and tearing the small hole wider. Inside, as always, was money. Bundles of cash. But instead of being green, it looked... royal blue. Almost purple. Across the front was a picture of Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the founder of Pakistan. These weren't dollars. They were... rupees, Houdini said.
Pakistani money.
It made no sense. Their deliveries were always in U.S. dollars. 1 or 2 times in Iraqi dinars. If someone was sending new currency...
Bitch of a bitch, Houdini blurted, pulling out a stack of cash and flipping through it.
A 1,000 Pakistani rupee bill was on top, but the rest of the pile was... all of it was blank. It's blue construction paper, Houdini said. He flipped through the rest. All three stacks were the same. All of it worthless. This wasn't a delivery. It was a trap.
You need to get out of there.
Houdini glanced over his shoulder. Through the frosted glass, the secretary went to stand up, then sat back down, like she was talking to someone who just arrived.
You need to get out of there, the man repeated.
Let me just get out of there, now. Houdini slammed the receiver down, but just as he turned, phoom, the glass door flew open. Nola stormed inside, her gun pointed at Houdini's head.
You must be Roan.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. You have the wrong...
They call you Houdini. Your real name is Roan Johansson. You're from Scotts Bluff, Nebraska.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Nola pulled back the hammer on her gun, aiming it at his forehead.
I'm now going to shoot you in the face. You have 3 seconds to prevent it.
Your boss.
I don't have a boss.
Call him whatever you want. You're too stupid to do this yourself.
So that person you were just talking to, she said, her finger tightening around the trigger. Tell me where he is.
56. He was too calm. That was Nola's first thought.
Take a breath, I'm not your enemy,
Houdini said, chewing his gum, his hands raised casually in the air. He wasn't sweating, seemed unafraid. Maybe just dumb. You know who I am? Nola challenged, her guns still pointed at his face.
Nola, the one who died.
The one you tried to kill.
Not me.
Wrong guy, Houdini said, lowering his chin and offering a conspiratorial grin, like they were on the same side. He was a charmer, a natural salesman, like a lawyer but with less polish. She eyed his gum chewing. More street smart than book smart. He wasn't a dummy, though. Deep crow's feet were in the corner of his right eye. His left eye was clean. That's his aiming eye. A hunter, definitely right-handed. He chewed some more, short, quick bites. Impatient? Annoyed? Anxious? No. He kept on chewing, his grin never leaving his eyes. In control, like he knew what was coming. Nola glanced over her shoulder, turning toward the door. Too late. Gah! She never saw the person behind her. An arm wrapped around her neck as 4 metal blades, like a metal paw, pressed hard against her throat.
Your day's about to take a noticeable turn for the worse,
the tall Native American woman whispered.
Nola Brown,
Houdini said, still chewing his gum as he stood there on the carpet linoleum border between the conference room and kitchenette.
I want you to meet our dear friend, the
In a burst, the glass door to the conference room shattered, bits of aqua shards spraying everywhere. A metal rolling chair was still in midair, thrown through the door by... Zig raced into the room as the metal chair somersaulted, colliding into the curtain, catching her off balance.
Don't move! She goes down, you go down!
Zig shouted, jamming the tip of his knife into the back of the curtain's neck. She started to turn, but he wedged it in there, through her black field jacket.
This is your C7,
he told her, pushing his knife between her 6th and 7th vertebrae.
That's what protects your spinal cord. If you ever want to move your arms or walk again, you need to let go of her.
Tell Nola to drop her gun, the curtain challenged, her claw weapon still at Nola's throat. Nola didn't budge, her gun still aimed at Houdini.
Everyone take a breath, Zig said. Nola, listen to the man,
Houdini warned, amping up the charm as he backed up a few steps into the kitchenette.
Put your gun down or you're gonna get your throat slit. No one's slitting anyone's throat, Zig insisted. Put the gun down, Nola,
Houdini repeated, chewing his blam. Nola pulled the trigger, shooting Houdini directly in the throat. 57. Homestead, Florida, 10 years ago. This was Nola when she was 16.
What's wrong?
Nola asked, clearly anxious. Ms. Sable laughed. Can you just close your eyes and stop worrying? Sitting across from Ms. Sable at the wide art table, Nola closed her eyes, but she couldn't stop worrying. Not after that night a few years back when Royal covered her eyes.
They closed?
Ms. Sable asked. Nola nodded, hearing her teacher rummage through her purse.
Thwap.
Something hit the wooden table.
Open.
Nola opened her eyes, staring down at a rectangular box the size of a brick. It was covered in Muppet wrapping paper that featured Fozzie, Miss Piggy, and of course Kermit, in the middle of a celebratory Kermit flail. A present.
I'm a crappy wrapper. The paper is all we had left from when Dominic was little,
Ms. Sable explained, referring to her son. Nola looked at it like someone took a dump on the desk. Why would...
What's this for?
This weekend was your birthday, wasn't it? I believe that entitles some of us to say, Happy Birthday.
Nola fidgeted with the cuffs on the jean jacket she'd bought at Goodwill on Ms. Sable's recommendation. Girls shouldn't be walking around in wife-beater tank tops. Nola still wore the tank underneath, but every day she wore the jacket.
Miss Sable,
when someone gives you a present, say, thank you.
But you...
Try it, okay? Thank you.
Thank you,
Nola repeated, unable to look up at her teacher. Miss Sable opened her mouth, ready to lecture her about eye contact, but it was her birthday. Tearing at the wrapping paper and opening the narrow box, Nola was hit by the smell first. Her favorite smell over these past few months. Freshly sharpened
pencils. Cool,
Nola said, revealing half a dozen professional quality pencils, each in its own pristine plastic case.
It's not much. Teacher's salary, Miss Sable said. But you know, for sketching.
Nola nodded, flashing a hint of the ruined smile that always broke Miss Sable's heart. Like Nola was afraid to commit to a full grin, or didn't know how.
They're all different,
Nola said.
That's the point. As you know, the number on the side is their lead grade, and a 4B is softer than a 2B. Each has a different touch, like a different brush. When I bought Dominic his first baseball mitt, this handsome guy at the Sports Authority told me it all started with the right equipment. That's how he got me wasting $50 for a glove for a kid who hated baseball. Anyway, there you go. Now you have it. The right equipment.
For the rest of her life, Nola would come back to this moment, relishing it, thinking about it, replaying it in her head. In the next few months, when Nola's life imploded and her soul was ripped to shreds, she'd need this day more than ever. Leaning down toward the box, she'd never seen anything so beautiful. She hesitated on the word, but that was the right one. Beautiful. Over and over, she reread the names of all the different pencils. Mungo, Faber, Stadler, Ticonderoga, and Swan.
Just you wait. You haven't even seen part two yet, Miss Sable said, darting to her office, a small closet in the back corner of the art room.
She ran like an athlete, Nola thought, realizing for the very first time how little she knew about Miss Sable's life outside of school. There was some whispering, like Miss Sable was talking to someone.
Close your eyes, Miss Sable called out.
This time, Nola didn't hesitate.
Nola, just so you know, this is a potential gift. You don't have to take it, okay? Only if your dad says it's fine.
Nola nodded, eyes still shut and so excited she didn't even hear the mention of Royal.
Okay. Open. Look.
On the art table was a cardboard box, big enough that it could hold an old computer monitor. The box wasn't wrapped, wasn't even closed. Something moved inside, scratching wildly. Something alive.
I'm warning you, you don't have to take this. It's my son's, and he's leaving for... He enlisted in the army, God bless him. They're gonna pay for his college. He says he'll eventually ask to be stationed at the base here, she said, referring to the nearby Homestead Air Reserve base. Anyway, he's my different one, never on the conventional path. So when he said he couldn't take pets with him, well, happy birthday part two, Miss Sable said, quickly adding, if you want it. Nola lunged forward, ruined smile on her face. Here, let me introduce you, Miss Sable said, reaching into the box and pulling out. It had elegant black fur and a red bow taped to its collar. It looked like a cat, but as the light hit it...
A skunk?
Before you judge, it's been de-scented, Miss Sable explained. So no stink bombs, no rotten smell. Don't ask how we got him. My son's idea. But he's been with us for 4 years now. They act like cats, though. Eat cat food, use a litter box. They just look like, well, like this. Nola stared at the skunk as it gracefully prowled across the art desk, cocking its head sideways at Nola. A skunk. Even Nola knew this was weird. Another thing for her classmates to point at. Another thing to make fun of. Another thing to make her different.
Does she have a name?
El Duque. I think it's the name of an old baseball player, though we call him Dooch. She's a he. Nola stood there a moment.
I want him,
she decided, pulling Dooch close into a hug. Dooch relished the touch, rubbing his cheek against Nola's arm. He didn't smell at all, and he moved just like a cat. Nola, there's something in everyone that's beautiful. Your job is to unlock it. That sounds like a yoga quote,